It happens 4 times a year. And it happens because the seasons change and you make adjustments. Excuse me a second, just getting tangled up. And you make adjustments. And the adjustments are sunglasses go away and the scarves come out as summer turns into autumn. Or the winter coats come out as October, November, December marches on. Or the garden furniture goes away for another few months until the sun comes back out again. Or the garden gets a good cut down as you prepare for autumn and winter. We make changes for each change of season, don't we? And if we don't make those changes, we get caught out. You don't want to be in your sandals in November, do you? You don't want to be in your woolies in the middle of the summer, although last week you could have got away with it. The crowds are looking at Jesus and they're seeing something different. They're looking at Jesus and his disciples and they're seeing something different. And they're realizing that what they think and what they do is not fit for what he is and he's doing and saying. So last week we looked at a story where Jesus was sitting and feasting with Matthew and Matthew's friends, the sinners and tax collectors. Do you remember? And the question came from the crowd to the disciples, what's he doing? This week the question comes the other way round. The crowd can see Jesus' disciples acting differently. And so they go to Jesus and say, why aren't they fasting like us? What are they doing? And so there's this triggering of questions, observing that things are changing and people are trying to get their heads around it. There may be an element of rebellion. We don't like Jesus. We don't like his disciples that stand against him. But probably it's just puzzlement. They're different. Why? Christ is Jesus eating with sinners and tax collectors. What's going on? His disciples, the religious, they've left their workplaces like Levi, Matthew. But they're not doing what religious people do. They're not fasting like we do. What's going on? Very simply, this first section, there's two sections in the passage. First section is through to verse 17, Jesus' history's turning point. He brings the questioners to three pictures. One is a celebration, one is a sower, and one is the cellar for the wine. And he's teaching them that he is the watershed point. That he changes everything. So the question is, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? That comes from John the Baptist's disciples. And these three stories follow on from Jesus, these three pictures. All of them are saying something very, very similar. It is inappropriate for things to carry on as they once did. More precisely, verse 15, the first picture of the bridegroom. It's inappropriate because Jesus' presence brings joy. And the picture he uses is that of a bridegroom at a party. Verse 16, there's the two kinds of cloths. There's the old shrunk cloth and the new unshrunk cloth. And you don't put those two things together. There'll be devastation. There are two things that are incompatible. Fasting is inappropriate when the joy and the presence of the bridegroom should be obvious. And it is incompatible to put the practices of how religion has been exercised with who Jesus is now. He is changing the landscape. The last one, I think, is telling us that who Jesus is, what he's teaching, and what he will do is uncontainable by the old system. Jesus is shaking things up, and he's demonstrating to everybody who will look to these changing things, and they must change too. It is inappropriate to be fasting when the joy of the bridegroom is present. It is incompatible to put new things onto old. Jesus can't just be attached into the present system of thinking about God. And it is uncontainable. Who Jesus is, what he's doing, and what he will do cannot be contained by the old system. Let me just take that first picture that Jesus gives. The picture of the bridegroom. It's a really weighty image because it's one of those pictures that God uses in the Old Testament about his relationship with his people. God uses pictures to help us get our heads around how God treats us and deals with us often, though we deserve something different. So one of the classic pictures in the Old Testament is God is shepherd and his people is sheep. It's used many times. And the sheep are wanderers, but the shepherd pursues and protects and brings them back. The sheep are lost or even unshepherded by the rulers of the people, but God himself will come one day and shepherd his people. The shepherd image is a well-used image. There's another image that is of God as Father, but that's not a picture, that's a reality. God as Father, and the people become his children. Well, here's another image. God as bridegroom and his people, though, to put it bluntly, undeserving, ugly and unfaithful, they are the much loved people of God who become the bride. He lavishes love. And he sticks with them, even though they're undeserving. And his love will transform them to be faithful people. So here's one reference from Isaiah chapter 54. For your maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. Not because he's created, but because he is saved. And the Holy One of Israel is your redeemer. God in his creating, but in his saving as well, marries his people. That's the picture. And it's a picture of love. Undeserved and unreserved love. He lavishes love on his people. One person I was listening to this week talks about God's steadfast love as the love that drives God to extremes. That's a good definition. God's steadfast love is the love that drives God to extremes. And one of the extremes that we see steadfast love exercising is, who does he love? He loves people who do not deserve it. He loves people who are on their own, deserve to be unloved, cast out. And so this picture of a bridegroom loving and marrying people that they would become his bride. And then he transforms the bride. He beautifies the bride with his love. It's one of the Old Testament pictures. It's probably most famously known through the prophet Hosea. Hosea gave the message and lived the message. His wife, he married a woman, a prostitute, and she was within the marriage bounds, unfaithful again. But the message from God was to Hosea was go and buy her back from slavery and love her again. Why did Hosea have such a message to live out? Because that was the love that God was demonstrating to his unfaithful people. The people were married to God and they were unfaithful. He would pursue them and bring them back. That was the promise. I will heal your waywardness, your backsliding, and I will love them freely, declares God in Hosea. And so that's the bridegroom image. The weight of it is significant in the Old Testament. So when Jesus talks about the bridegroom being with his people, he's taking, yet again, a picture of God and his people to himself. He's claiming, I suggest to you, deity. As he meets humanity in their need and their unworthiness, he's showing them that here is God enfleshed, engaged, and if you like, entangled with sinners, as one preacher puts it. Getting his sleeves rolled up and his hands dirty with the work. The change then that Jesus is making, he will make many claims in Matthew's gospel as he does throughout all the gospels. But at this point, at this early point in his ministry, he's telling those who are watching and observing that a change is happening that they must fall in line with. I remember, I've told this story before, I think. I used to be in the Boys Brigade as a young lad. Boys Brigade's a little bit like the Scouts, only far better. And one of the things that we used to do once a year, we used to march to the Cenotaph on Remembrance Sunday. It's a real crying shame that Remembrance Sunday's in November, because it's freezing, particularly in Northern Ireland, it's freezing. So you have to march from the church to the Cenotaph and stand there for an hour's service and then march back. By the time you get back, you're frozen. One of the funny bits of the day, and there weren't many, but one of them was, we had we had this group of lads, about 20, 25 of us, and we would leave our church and join the procession of other Boys Brigades from other churches. There's quite a few in town. So by the end of it, it was about 6 or 7 different brigades marching. And each brigade would have their own drummer who would left, 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 right, left. The funny thing was that our drum was going, their drum was going, their drum was going, and all the drums were echoing off the building. Well, you could pick any beat you wanted. And the idea of it was supposed to keep us in line, okay? Keep us in step. And more often than not, we would end up looking at each other going, you're out of step, you're out of step. And then I'd get a punch in the back from probably my brother saying, you're out of step as well. Well, and so the whole procession was an exercise of getting back in step, okay? Realizing we're out of line and getting back. And when Jesus reveals his glory, a huge part of humanity's response is just getting back in step. We are out of step with God. We're out of step with how he thinks and how he feels and how he acts and what he does. And as Jesus warns and invites and instructs the people, there's a bridegroom who gives joy. There's a different kind of cloth now. There's a different kind of wine now. Get in step with what God is doing. Don't keep marching. Don't keep walking according to your old ways. Come and join this king. This kingdom. Come and be part of what God is doing. That's the invitation and instruction. Now, we could spend a lot of time on that passage, but what I want you to do is why he is so glorious that we should want to follow him. And that brings us on to the next section. Okay, why is God so glorious that he brings us, that we should want to follow him? Very simply, Jesus is humanity's tender rescuer. Don't miss the fact that the stories that follow are about two females. In the Roman world, second-class citizens. Even within the Jewish culture, although they should have been honoured, they weren't as honoured as they should have been. One is a child, one is an old woman, both vulnerable. And Jesus treats them with astounding dignity. There's a lovely little moment where the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years touches the garment of Jesus. There are more details in Mark and Luke, but the Matthew's Gospel account is quite simple. If I only touch his garment, I'll be made well. Jesus turns to her, verse 22, and says, take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well. Tender words that repeat with dignity the honour he gave the paralysed man that we looked at a few weeks ago. Do you remember that the man is brought in by his friends? Chapter 9, verse 2. Have a look. Chapter 9, verse 2. And Jesus says to the paralysed man lying in front of him, he says the exact same words. Take heart. It's a man talking to a man. There's a mutual respect within the culture. Take heart. But then when Jesus is talking to this old woman who is debilitated by the condition, defiled because of her uncleanness and separated from her community. He speaks in exactly the same way as he did to the man. Take heart. Jesus treats with astounding equality those who are oppressed by the culture, those who are despised by the culture, because in his kingdom, that is not the way it's supposed to be. So I want you to see also, not just that equality of between Jesus treating men and Jesus treating women. I want you to see as well the diversity of the circumstances. One of the things that's been a feature of our church life over the last perhaps 2 or 3 or 4 years is we've become increasingly conscious that our church family, some of them, are walking paths that they've had to walk not just for a few weeks, but a few months and a few years. The term chronic applies to many in the church for illness, for disability, mental, emotional, physical. And here is a woman who has known a chronic condition. In Luke's gospel, we're told she spent all her money on doctors trying to seek remedy, but none could be found. Here's a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. It places her outside the community, outside access to the temple, and it places her as a very vulnerable member of society. And her hope, her faith, is expressed in verse 21. If I only touch his garment, I will be made well. She believes that he's the fixer. She touches, and this chronic condition disappears as Jesus utters those words, "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well." Why does he say it? He says it so she knows it. And he says it so that other people hear it as well. She's reinstated. She's back in the community. She's healed, and he just wants other people to know she's healed too. Because up to now, they know she's not healed. But the community knows, and she knows. This tender reintegration of this woman into the community. The word I've got on the screen, the word I've used a number of times already, spot the tenderness of Jesus. He is a woman who has suffered and suffered for a long time. What is Christ's response from heaven to those who know chronic conditions? His heart has not changed one bit. He cares deeply for any and all who know what chronic disease, pain is. This is important because some of you I'm looking at now know what this is like, or your loved ones do. Some of you are at home because you can't physically be here because this applies to you. See Christ's heart. This is not just an old people's thing, is it? It is not uncommon for our young people to be suffering with mental and emotional health. And they will not just struggle for a few weeks. Some may even struggle for the rest of their days on earth. There may be no seasons where they are well and seasons where they are unwell. What is Christ's response to the chronically ill? Tenderness. And as he gives us this glimpse of his tenderness, we're invited to trust him with our conditions. Knowing that one day, as he does here for this woman, knowing that one day he will heal all our diseases, Psalm 103. He will wipe away every tear. He will take away every sorrow. He will. And the pain of today, the chronic pain of today, some of you have suffered for longer than 12 years, the chronic pain of today will be put into an eternal perspective, and you will not be disappointed or angry or frustrated. But that the glories of Christ and the new creation will swallow up all the agonies of this day, all the agonies of these years. And Christ, the tender rescuer, knows. So can I encourage you, those of you who are trusting Christ, in the midst of walking through this dark valley that some of you are experiencing, keep trusting him. He is tender. He is trustworthy. And one day, for all who trust him, it will disappear. It will disappear. We go from the chronically ill to the fatally wounded. One of the heartaches of living in this world is the experience of grief and the anticipation of death. Here is a man who, no doubt, if he could, would swap places with his daughter. This father comes, daughter has died. He comes to Jesus in much the same way as the woman did. If only she thinks, if I can touch his garment, I'll be made well. It's remarkable what he asks of Jesus. My daughter has died, but come, lay your hand on her and she'll live. That is stunning, isn't it? And we're introduced here in his cry to the powerlessness of us as human beings in the face of death. We can't even put it in the right order. If only those who died were over 70 or 80, we would handle it better. But the reality is, children die before parents and grandparents. And that hurts, doesn't it? Here is a Christ who meets a man whose daughter has died. And with the same tenderness that he speaks to the woman and says, take heart. He deals with this man's heartache. One of the experiences of Christians, for some, is that when tragedies come, real tragedies come, very often to do with our children or grandchildren, and we don't like them, we don't like those tragedies at all, we can turn our back on God as if somehow we are entitled to something different. Well, here is a man who comes with the example of faith, asking Jesus to step in. Christ here demonstrates his ability, his authority over death, and to give life. It is highly unlikely that the Lord will resurrect or resuscitate our loved ones. But one day, all those who have trusted in him will be resurrected. And again, like the healing of all our diseases, there will be no disappointment. That beautiful picture, declared in the Old Testament, repeated in the New, that he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. One of the precious words in that promise is every, isn't it? And here is a man, Jesus Christ, who walks into the mourning party, the grieving ongoings, and tells him to go. And then again, it's a picture of tenderness, isn't it? He takes the girl by the hand and raises her up. Here is a man who is greater than chronic sickness and has more authority over death. That authority over death will one day be displayed by himself when the tomb is emptied gloriously. And not just death is confronted and found wanting, but its cause, the sin of humanity, is found conquered in the empty tomb. Here is Jesus Christ, brothers and sisters, the tender rescuer of humanity's great ills. Very briefly, take note. when Jesus talks about himself being sort of the bridegroom or the new wine or incompatible with the old two cloths, he's claiming that he's a watershed point, that from now on things should be different. And when he heals the woman and he raises the dead, you've got to question that. These two stories are supposed to back up the claim of Jesus. God in flesh, entangled with sinners for their rescue. Look what he can do. There's nobody else like him. Take note. Christ is, if you like, advertising himself as unique in all of humanity. And as he's advertising himself, he's inviting people. Here's a man I can trust. Here is a man I must trust. And that leads me on to the second one. Take heart. Many of you know what chronic illness is. Many of you know what it is to grieve over the loss of a loved one, whether the person has been older than you or younger than you. The tenderness of Jesus Christ in both cases demonstrates even further than the stories before and the stories that will come. There are many stories of his wonderful tenderness to deal with us in all our sorrow. And one day, to so finish with our sorrow that there'll be nothing but everlasting joy and gladness. And as he says to the woman, take heart. Can I suggest to you, we're supposed to be assured. Christ, pictured here, speaking, acting. We're supposed to take heart. Look at what my God is like. Look at what my God can do. Look at what he promises. Look at what he will fulfill perfectly, ultimately, one day. Look. Supposed to do our hearts good. Lastly, take after him. What do I mean? God's mission through Jesus Christ, through the story of the gospel and the appointing of the apostles and the appointing of the handing down of the truth from the apostles to the generation of churches that follow, means that Christ's mission is our mission. We don't have the authority to raise the dead, but we do have the authority to tell people about Jesus who can raise the dead, who has conquered death. God's character is not just look at what your God is like. God's character is also our calling. Become like the God you worship. Is he tender? How should we be? Tender. Is he loving? How should we be? Loving. Does he get entangled with sinners for their rescue? How should we be? Entangled with sinners, concern for their rescue. Take after him. Become like your dad. Family likeness. Come to Jesus. Be conformed to Jesus and commend him to others. There is no one like him. Present to you Jesus Christ. Love him. Become like him. And hold him out to others. Because men and women, boys and girls, need this Jesus Christ just like we do. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the unique Jesus. We thank you for the beautiful revelation, the picture of him here in this conversation and in the confronting of sickness and death. We thank you that one day all sorrows will find their place in eternal joy and gladness. We thank you that every sickness will be healed and death will be conquered. You do our hearts good as we gaze on the glory of Jesus Christ. Amen.